Weapons down, I whisper to Cassie when she draws her pistol. We're not a threat to them. Cassie grimaces. But for all we know, one of these men could be an ancestor of... None of those white boys is my ancestor, Cassie says. Cass, fine. She tucks the handgun back into her pants. But if one of them looks at me funny, I'll be the first to put up a fuss. I pat the holstered gun on my hip. This isn't the Wild West, but I'm still a quick draw and a better shot than most. I'd rather not shoot down men with whom I have no quarrel, but Cassie and Levi are under my care, and there isn't anyone or anything, now or in the past, that will stand in my way. Cassie nods and I stand up, acting surprised when the hobbling man nearly careens into me. But my act is not nearly as dramatic as the stranger's. He simultaneously reels back and pitches forward while shouting, "Good Lord!" Rather than allow the man to fall into the stream, potentially injuring himself and our chances of a peaceful encounter, I catch him in my arms. The man's bright blue eyes are offset by a beard full of crumbs, rotting teeth, and a stench that nearly forces me to drop him. The only thing about him that's familiar is the dry black stain of coal on his clothes and beneath his nails. "Arthur!" calls out the nearest of the men, the one with the revolver. Of the bunch, he is the best dressed, in a tattered suit coat which is free of coal. His face is covered in a thin layer of stubble, but he would have been clean-shaven a few days ago. They're on the run, I realize. But from whom and why?
"I'm all right,"
Arthur calls out as I set him upright and ease him down onto the spring's embankment. He looks me in the eyes, his gaze penetrating.
"Thank you kindly for the assistance."
"Weren't nothing," I say, laying on my accent a little thick. It faded during my years in the military, but falling back into it is easy. The rest of Arthur's men arrive a moment later. Those with weapons have them aimed mostly toward me, but there's one rifle covering Levi and one on Cassie. But these men don't look like fighters. Judging by the coal staining their clothing, they'd be more comfortable holding pickaxes than rifles. They're also exhausted and desperate, more interested in the water gurgling behind me than they are in the newcomers they've stumbled across.
"Don't let us slow you down,"
I say, arms raised, stepping away from the spring.
"Have at it."
The well-dressed man motions Arthur to the spring. The man descends on the spring like a thirsty vampire, sucking blood from the earth's neck. He gags and slurps as he drinks with abandon.
"Name's Charles Whalen,"
the well-dressed man says, his revolver leveled at my chest.
"What are y'all doing out here?"
"Hunting," I say. He looks us over.
"Don't see no rifle."
"Don't need one," I tell him, and motion to the gun on my hip. He'll recognize it for what it is, but it's different enough from anything he'd have seen that he might just believe the lie.
"Ain't nobody hunts with a pistol," he says. "Ain't nobody can shoot like him,"
Levi says.
"Once I him take the..."
"Levi," I say, trying to prevent him from making claims I can't follow through on. Last thing we need is these men challenging me to shoot a fly off a leaf at 50 feet or some such thing.
"Mind yourself, boy."
The last bit is to let Levi and Charles know that he's my subordinate. Cassie plays it smart, staying quiet, eyes on the ground. I'm not entirely sure of the year, but even though slavery is a thing of the past, this is still the South, pre-civil rights movement.
"I picked this up in Germany," I say, gambling with the year. "Took it from a dead kraut. Packs a punch and it's more accurate than any weapon has a right to be."
My claim seems to impress the lot of them. When several of the men glance toward Charles, I have no doubt that he actually fought in the war, which puts the year sometime after 1918.
"Who'd you serve under?" Charles asks.
Part of my education was a study of military history. When it comes to warfare, not repeating history isn't just about learning how to prevent wars, it's about avoiding the mistakes made on the battlefield. And both world wars were full of mistakes.
"Major Whittlesey."
When Charles's eyes widen, I know he understands what that means, and I hope he wasn't one of the other 194 men who survived the horrible events in the Argonne Forest. If he was, I'll really have to stretch the limits of my historical knowledge and my ability to bullshit.
77th Division,
I continue, as if he doesn't understand.
"He knows what you did,"
Arthur says, standing up from the spring. His chest is soaked with water.
"Not many men who served haven't heard of the Lost Battalion, surrounded by Germans, abandoned by the French, and shelled by your own forces. You walked out of that means you're a survivor."
"Also means you have our respect," Charles says. There aren't many things that offend soldiers more than stolen valor, but I'll deal with the guilt if and when we survive this mess.
Also, I'd like to think my own service makes this a case of borrowed valor rather than stolen. I offer my hand to Charles and give him my actual name and rank. Captain Owen McCoy. As the man shakes my hand, his face contorts again. McCoy? I forgot that my last name carries a lot of weight in these parts. Some of these men would have been alive for the infamous Hatfield-McCoy feud that claimed dozens of lives and became an American legend. Since then, the McCoy name has been recognizable and respected in Kentucky. But who's to say these men are from Kentucky? The shift in mood is subtle. Whatever respect being part of the Forgotten Battalion garnered me, my last name erased.
Don't hold his name against him, Levi says. He can be an overbearing prick, believe you me, but he ain't had no part in the events of past years.
And you are? Charles asks.
Levi Hatfield.
I think he's laid it on a little thick. Running into a McCoy in the woods is one thing, but stumbling across a Hatfield and a McCoy together, they're not likely to believe his story. But then he goes and frosts his liar's cake with a surprising layer of history.
I'm Sid's cousin, twice removed. Heard what happened. Was coming to help.
The lie is impressive. Not only does Levi know his local mining history, Sid Hatfield was gunned down by the law on the steps of a courthouse where he was surrendering. As the leader of a mining revolt, he'd become a regional hero and an enemy of the federal government. All of this took place in Virginia, home of the Hatfields. That these men are here in Kentucky means they were part of Sid's crew, now on the run from the law. Knowing that also gives me a year. 1921.
With the McCoy? Arthur asks. I saved his life, Levi says. The man owes me.
Charles sags a little bit, the fight going out of him.
Well, then, I'm sorry to tell you, you're too late to do any good. Sid's dead.
What? Levi's overreaction borders on the edge of believability. He might know his history, but acting is not his forte.
How?
They shot him and Ed Chambers dead in front of their wives, Charles says. Right at the courthouse, if you can believe it. We put up a fine stink, wounded a few of them, but they had the numbers and the guns. We've been on the run since.
Charles purses his lips, thinking, and then adds, You're more than welcome to join us.
He motions to me. Present company excluded. Back to Levi.
But the best thing you can do is go back where you came from. Live your life best you can. I reckon we ain't long for this world. Best not throw in with us.
This is a test, I think. The Hatfield and McCoy feud went on so long and claimed so many lives because the families were fiercely loyal. Levi turning his back on Sid's men would prove that we've been lying up until now. While Charles can't prove any of this, he smells the stink of our horseshit. If Levi turns him down, he's likely to gun us all down. The sound of horse hooves prevents Levi from answering, but it does nothing to improve our situation.
The law!
One of the men shouts, adjusting his aim away from Cassie and toward the woods, where the sound is coming from.
They done found us!
The 10 men all but forget about us, taking up positions behind trees. Those with rifles prepare to fire. Those without wield knives and tree branches. Each and every one of them is prepared to go down fighting, and I'm pretty sure that's supposed to be their fate. But it's not ours.
Like it or not, Charles says, you're with us now.
He takes up position with his men, turning his back on us. We could shoot them in the backs or flee, but when I hear the thunder of hooves approaching from behind, too, I realize he's right. The men gunning for Charles and his people are going to shoot on sight. Guilt by proximity. When Charles hears the hooves coming from behind, he turns around and gives me a wink.
This feels familiar, right? Surrounded by the enemy, outgunned, outmanned.
More than you'd ever believe, I say, drawing my sidearm. You and your man handle the front, we'll deal with the men on this end. I give Cassie a nod, and she draws her pistol from behind her back. The look on Charles's face is amusing, but I don't linger to enjoy it. A dozen armed men on horseback stampede toward us through the trees and time itself.